Hello, I'm Taboo.
And I'm Church.
And we are the Dark Souls 2.
And welcome to the Dark Souls 2. In this episode, we'll be discussing the opening areas of the game. That includes things betwixt the tutorial area and Majula, which is kind of the home base of the character. We're going to be covering off the details of those areas in some depth, including the lore. What that means is that spoilers are going to be discussed. So if you haven't played those areas yet, a good idea might be to go and play them before you listen.
Now, with that out the way, we're going to start again with a few beginner tips. We gave out a few last episode, but having played a little bit more, we've got some we think every new player should know.
Yeah, so for instance, a good one is to talk to everyone repeatedly.
What's unclear about the game is that when you talk to someone and they finish saying what they have to say, it doesn't let you know that you should go back and talk to them again. So pressing the X button or the A button standing in front of them actually continues the conversation. It's just a pause, but nobody tells you that.
It's unusual that way, but I kind of like that. It's a bit more participatory than someone just talking at you.
Correct. And second to that, you have to keep going back and talking to these people as well, because they have a storyline and you need to do certain things in the game to progress that storyline. And if you don't go back and talk to them, then they'll stay stagnant at that point for the rest of the game.
If somebody isn't hostile, don't attack them. NPCs often don't come back if you kill them and never forgive you if you piss them off.
Different to the previous games is an agility stat. If you're finding this game a bit sluggish, try raising that stat. It's going to affect how fast you can raise your shield and how quickly you can roll in combat.
Make sure that you level your weapons. I played a significant period of the game initially without spending any money, any souls that is, leveling up my weapon. And I found that once I started doing that, the game was much easier.
And don't just level weapons. It's important to make sure you level your armor and your shield as well.
And your catalyst. Consuming a human effigy reverses your hollowing and turns you into a human. That's the only way to fully access the multiplayer experience of the game. So if you're not seeing summon signs, that's probably why.
Okay, so now we're going to go into the lore section of our podcast. What we're going to cover from this point on is from the moment you hit new game. Let's begin. So this opening cinematic is what's going to set the feel for the rest of the game.
Absolutely, and I think that the game is a little bit more explicit with its storyline this time than Dark Souls was. Dark Souls was a little bit more nebulous and up in the air, whereas this game makes it clear, you know, you are cursed. The dark sign symbol is a curse. This is the curse that's afflicting the entirety of the world and is the reason that everything's fallen to ruin. Every person, it seems, after dying, comes back to life only to die again. And the implication is that the trauma of dying repeatedly drives you insane and you become what's called a hollow.
I really like the cinematic though, because what it shows is that you're being drawn to this world, which is we later learn is Drang Lake. And it's as though you're not actually in control of your own faculties. You're sort of drawn almost by urge or
compelled by some supernatural force. As the crone says, like a moth drawn to a flame. And I think that's really interesting. And I want to chat with you about that real quick and see what you think of it. So we see the protagonist approaching this decrepit city, which he's kind of predestined or prophesied to approach. And then he falls into this big whirlpool and wakes up somewhere else. It almost seems a little like the world you wake up in is disjointed from reality or from the world that you came from. And you will meet an NPC who will even describe that world as a place that exists between Drang Lake and the world beyond, or however she words it. So the point that I'm making is it's kind of like that is the traversing of timelines or the traversing of dimensions when you fall into that maelstrom and kind of wake up somewhere else.
Yeah, I think that has to be right. We're about to cover that in a moment when we get to a house a little further on. But Millibeth does describe the two worlds as being separate. It's as though you're in a limbo between the two when you fall into that maelstrom.
Absolutely. And the area you wake up in is even fittingly called Things Betwixt.
So on that note, you wake up at the bottom of what we presume to be the maelstrom, and you spawn in as a man wearing these tattered clothes. And I think that's important a little later when you get into the tutorial area, but we'll cover that in a second. What you quickly do is move on to a section where you come across, I suppose, your first real enemy in the game?
Yeah, a bunch of little half-monkey, half-rat dogs.
Yeah, they're a weird bunch. You can easily not provoke them and just move on, and which is what I'd probably suggest doing, because they don't attack unless you provoke them, and at the moment they don't really seem to be too relevant to anything.
Exactly. It's not the easiest thing in the world to hit one, because you don't have a weapon, but I managed to do it, and it was a big mistake. They all just ganged up on me and killed me.
Yeah. Okay, so a little bit further up the track, though, you actually find a hidden path. If you go down it, you immediately see these big tracks in the sand, and they quickly lead up to what you later learn is the first ogre in the game.
And you can engage him, I assume, but bearing in mind that you are wearing crappy armor and have no weapon, probably not a good idea.
Yep. So if you duck around him, you can quickly pick up some gold pine resin and try not to get stomped. But I'm not really sure why he would be guarding that at the moment.
Yeah, I wonder if there's any implication to that. I mean, oftentimes in the previous game, the placement of items or the location of particular enemies had some kind of implication for the storyline or the way that the past laid out. So, I wonder about those kinds of things.
It doesn't seem terribly important at the moment, but yeah, the previous game was sometimes very poignant with where it left items, to the point where all the beginner classes, you could pick up their item sets at some point in the game and each place was relevant to where they sort of fell.
Yeah, and I love playing a game that's that detailed. And speaking of detail, that ogre's footsteps that you saw leading up to where he's standing, you will later notice that any ogres you encounter leave those footsteps on sand.
Yeah, it's just those little touches that really make the game. So we're about to move on to the house that's just around the corner, but before we do, there's actually a hidden item which comes in the form of a smooth and silky ball. I forget what they're called.
I think it's called a smooth and silky stone.
Yeah, smooth and silky stone, which we're going to explain in a bit more detail later in this episode. So, you walk through the door into the firekeeper's house, and you're greeted with another cinematic.
What seems to be the ruckus?
Oh my, your face. The face of the curse.
It's an undead. An undead has come to play.
They all end up here. All the ones like you.
You spoke to that kind old dear, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. So you've got a series of old crones, three of them sitting around a table, and pretty much straight away they start having a go at you.
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. So one of the things that they say is, you spoke to that kind old deer, didn't you? Which presumably they're implying the narrator from the opening cinematic, the toothless sort of blind lady. And we later learn from dialogue with Millibeth that they're actually three sisters and there was a fourth. We don't know what's happened to her at the moment. I'm leaning towards currently that she may be the fourth.
You know, I think that's the most likely thing as well. But there is another theory that I've been playing around with in my head. You will later meet a character called the Emerald Herald. She's early in the game and quite integral to the way the game is played. And I think she's fulfilling the duties of a firekeeper in some way. You know, she's hanging out by the bonfire. She's helping the protagonist progress. She has duties that are akin to the Maiden in Black from Demon Souls. I think there's a possibility that, you know, she's younger than the sisters in the room with you, but I think it's possible that the power of the bonfire keeps her youthful, because if you think about the duties of a firekeeper, that wouldn't be the kind of thing you could acquit in a lifetime, and that she's the fourth of the sisters. It's possible. I don't necessarily think it's likely, but it's worth thinking about.
Yeah, I actually never considered that. I suppose there's a possibility there.
So when we say that the crones are having a go at you, what we mean is that they're basically suggesting that you're fucked. They openly say to you, you don't stand a chance.
And yeah, they actually mock you and laugh at you fairly openly.
Yeah. And they even have a bit of dialogue where they make it very clear to you that you're going to die many,
over
many times.
And over again.
Which is one of the best things about these games, isn't it? Every video game that I've ever played, with some rare exceptions, you die and come back. It doesn't make much sense. But in the Souls universes, that's actually explained by the curse, which brings you back to life.
Hmm.
So first, the head old lady will ask you what your name is, more specifically if you even still remember your name.
So once you tell it to her, she next hands you an effigy and she sort of queries you and sees what you think of it. And what you learn from that is that the individual sees what they want to see out of the effigy and it's always an image of themselves. In this case, you can actually see the sort of scarring and burnt texture of it that represents the curse that you have or the dark sign that you have burnt into your shoulder.
You know, I actually never thought of it that way, that the human effigy, to me, doesn't look much like an effigy at all. But they say in the item description, firstly, that what you see depends on who's looking. And secondly, the protagonist looks at the effigy and then the crone confirms, that's right, it's an effigy of you, which suggests that actually there is some symbolism to the fact that it's kind of wrecked looking and uneven and burned and charred.
Now, the part that I found weird about this, and I don't know if you picked up on it, is she hands you the effigy in the cinematic, but directly after you get to walk around and you don't actually have an effigy.
Oh, really?
One of the starting gifts you can choose is an effigy, and there's also an effigy upstairs in the house that you can get out of a chest, but it just seems a bit like an inconsistency. I wonder if it was just an oversight, because she hands it to you, tells you about it, but then you later have to, I guess, find one in a chest.
Yeah.
So from here, you get to choose your starting class, which I'm sure you can all read about and choose one that fits your playstyle best, and your starting gift. Now, there's a few to choose from, and they each have their own relevance, I suppose, some more useful than others. I won't go into too much detail with them, but one of interest is the petrified something. We're going to cover that a little later again in this episode, so just remember that it comes up at this point. You can get one.
After you're free of that cinematic, you've picked your name and you've picked your class, then you get to go through and decide what you look like, which I've got to say, we mentioned this in the previous episode, so we won't go into it, but I found that a little bit out of step with the rest of the game. The fact that I can have a facial tattoo of a lion or a dragon or whatever, and
pink hair.
You know, if I was playing Final Fantasy and that happened, I think it would be in tune with the universe. Dark Souls is dark and grim, and it sucks, and it's supposed to be a constant reminder of the trauma of death. And the fact that I look like Vegeta doesn't really help that at all.
Look, on that note, one little thing that I picked up on that I think is worth pointing out. When you're creating your character, if you choose a color for your hair and for your skin that you like, my strong recommendation would be to pick that color and then go one or two shades darker, because when you actually spawn into the game, I don't know if you noticed, but it gets washed out and it doesn't. Yeah. It's not an accurate representation of what you saw in the character creation screen.
Yeah, and you gave me that advice and I followed it. And I think even though I chose a couple of shades darker than what I wanted, I still look a bit pale. So, take your point. So you then become free of that cutscene. You get to walk around a little bit. And that's when you can talk to Millibeth, who is the kind of caretaker of the crones.
My name is Millibeth. The old women were once fire keepers. I am here to look after them. It is what my mother did, and her mother before her, and so on.
She's the one that explains to you there used to be four of them, and she also explains to you that they were once fire keepers, and she also says that her family line have always looked after the crones, which reinforces the idea that the firekeepers are superhuman and last an awful long time, and again is kind of in tune with the possibility, which I don't think is super likely, that the Emerald Herald is a firekeeper.
And these ones have started to decay since they've stopped doing their firekeeper duties?
Well, maybe it's the power of the fire that makes you live eternally, and we know that fires seem to be some kind of nexus between timelines and realities, and we know as well the characters in both games have spoken about the soothing nature of fire and the fact that fire is integral for life and connected to the soul and everything.
So, holds off the Age of Darkness, or in this case, the curse.
Yeah, so maybe there's just something magic about hanging out by a bonfire.
Sure. So once you're done talking to the NPCs, the old ladies mostly just laugh at you again, you get to the first bonfire, which is just outside the door. Once you've kindled that first bonfire, it's worth having a quick look around the area, because you get to pick up your first torch and you also get a Soul of Lost Undead. So I think it's worth briefly touching on the whole torch dynamic for this game, because it's a completely new thing to the Souls universe.
So the way that it works is that at a bonfire or a lit sconce, if you have a torch in your inventory, you can light it there. So the way that you have to light it at a bonfire is to approach the bonfire and wait for the option to toggle. And that switches between the option to rest at the bonfire and the option to light your torch. So once you light your torch, it has 5 minutes of life. If you pick up two torches, you have 10 minutes of life.
Yeah, so every torch you find in the world actually adds 5 minutes to the total torch time you have.
So having the torch out and lit chews up its life. You can then go to other sconces and light the sconces using the torch and come back to the sconces later and relight and extinguish torch at that sconce.
Correct. So putting the torch away at any point puts it out. That's why it's important to sometimes have a couple of sconces around the place lit in case you ever want to go back and light your torch mid-level without having to traipse all the way back to the bonfire. So we now get to enter the first proper area of the game, which is the tutorial area. Most of the tutorial is taught you through these little stones that stick out of the ground. Nothing really lore significant there, but you get to go through and you see your first few enemies. And what's interesting is you notice that the enemies sometimes drop and are wearing the same tattered clothes that you spawned into the game with when you first landed at the bottom of the maelstrom.
Yes, and interestingly as well, the description of those items, if you look in your inventory, lays out the fact that, actually what it says is, the cursed souls who wander the land have a strange way of ending up here, as if drawn from afar by some force. It reinforces that idea that the inevitable fate of someone afflicted by the curse is to wind up in Dranglake.
As though it wasn't even their choice.
Exactly.
They were just drawn there by the power of that curse.
Precisely.
And so the fact that these undead enemies are there wearing the same clothes suggests that they too have started the journey like you, but maybe not even made it out of the tutorial, which I could probably forgive them, because goddamn, that tutorial wasn't like any other tutorial from any other game I've played. It was unforgiving.
Yeah, completely. And I think that's really interesting. You know, we know from Dark Souls that the enemies you're fighting were once just like you, often on the same course as you, be it individually or in the case of the Baldur Knights, as a party, and they ended up succumbing to the effects of the curse, which is why they hunger for your souls and want to kill you. And obviously, we're facing off enemies first thing that are in the same boat as us.
Hmm. So the first fog gate off to the left, you get to pick up a second dagger if you started with a class that came with one, or your first dagger. And a little later, you come across I call them the shampoo and conditioner duo, Smooth and Silky.
You, give it, Smooth.
Yes, you, give us Silky.
But it turns out they actually have real names, which you never learn through the game. So you have to learn this through reading developer notes and extra extraneous things to the game. Their names are Dinah and Tilo. So do you understand how the dynamic with Dinah and Tilo works?
It originally comes from Demon Souls, and it was in Dark Souls and now in Dark Souls 2. You drop an item in the nest of the crow, and we don't know that they're specifically crows because you don't see them.
It's always been presumed.
It's always been presumed they were crows. They will replace that item with something that you might like. So being crows, they like things that are shiny, silky things. They like shiny things at least. And so these crows are no different. They want something that they enjoy interacting with, and in return you get an item for it.
Yeah, so in the previous games you could experiment highly and drop all manner of things. In this game, it seems to be a little bit more specific. We mentioned earlier in the tutorial that if you are exploring a lot, you may have come across a smooth and silky stone.
I think.
And dropping any smooth and silky stone in their nest will yield a random reward. Unlike the other games as well, little pro tip, you don't have to go to a bonfire or die or exit the game to get the new item to spawn. Simply dropping an item in the nest will immediately exchange it if they were going to allow you to.
Really interestingly and very mercifully, they tell you straight away if they're not going to trade with you. So you drop it on the ground and they'll say, no, not like that. And in the previous games, you drop something on the ground, often you have to exit the game, come back to the game, the same item sitting there, and it's like, oh my god, I'll try something else.
Yeah, but in this case, we mentioned earlier that one of the starting gifts was the petrified something, and even in the description for that item, it sort of says this may have a use, and it's kind of very nebulous. It doesn't really tell you what it's for.
I think it also says it's pleasant to touch, doesn't it?
It does, which I think is a big hint, if you're being really lateral with the game, because they are asking for smooth and silky things, and this petrified something being pleasant to the touch, it suggests that you can drop it in their nest. And sure enough, what it does is drops a random item, but the beauty of this, the petrified something, is it drops a high tier random item from their nest. So you can basically get some of the rarer items from the game by dropping the petrified something there. Yeah.
In the tutorial very, very early. So that's interesting. I don't much like their voices.
No.
Give us Smooth.
Yeah, it's odd, definitely. I was much more fond of the two crows from the previous games.
Yep.
Sort of kind of felt a bit mashed in this time, you know, to keep the theme. So a lot like the rest of the game, there's little things you can do to interact with the environment that allows you shortcuts to places. And there's a ladder right next to the nest for Dinah and Tilo. So be sure to kick that down before you move on. It'll help you get back to them later.
And also, I think there's a secret ledge there where if you drop down, you can pick up a soul of a lost undead.
So moving on from here, there's the second fog gate, which not everyone's going to go through all of these tutorials, but I think it's definitely worth it because there's items throughout, and A lot of them are hidden, but if you're being very observant, you'll come across these interesting things. So with this one, you sort of have to jump over a ledge to get to some amber herbs. Another little pro tip here is if you're having trouble making that jump, there is an option in the game settings to change between jumping with the R3 button or jumping with the circle button, which is what you would have been used to from Dark Souls 1. I had to change it back because I was just struggling too much with that R3 change. Yeah, I just couldn't deal with it. But if you turn around, there's a ladder here, which I missed the first time, but I learned was there from watching Church play through. So it was interesting to see, but what I found interesting is if you go up the ladder and down into the next area, there's this little room off to the side which has a corpse and three cracked red eye orbs. I just found it odd that they were there, of all places. I don't know why they would have been.
I mean, it's a bit early in the game, isn't it?
It did sort of feel that way. I don't know. Maybe we're looking into it too much.
What does the cracked red eye orb do?
It allows you to invade into another person's world and try and take them out for, well, in the previous game, their humanity, or in this game, who knows so far? We haven't been made aware yet of just what invading other people's worlds and killing them does. You definitely get souls.
The third Frog Gate is probably one of the most interesting ones. Once you fight your way through the NPCs around the place, reading those little tablets that tell you the controls, you get to an area with two ogres. You find one of the more interesting artifacts in the game.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a lot of lore surrounding this one. It kind of stands by itself for the moment, as far as I can tell. It's an odd addition to the game. I'm not sure why it's there, but basically it changes your gender just by entering into it. It's this sarcophagus that sits on the shoreline, and I've heard in early versions of the beta, getting into it, you actually triggered a cinematic where you would float off and it would sort of feel like you might have been going to a new area. But in this final version, you get in, it cuts to a loading screen, it cuts back, you get out, and you're like, oh, sweet, new area, and you step straight into ogres, and as you mentioned earlier, it took your penis.
Now, before you go into Majula, where the game proper begins, don't forget that there's that hidden ogre that you found before you entered the crone's hut. So now might be a good time to go back and have a crack at him. He's got a decent amount of souls and he's carrying a ring that's very valuable.
Yeah, so now the risk of the tutorial level is over. Carrying those souls into Majula proper may be a nice boon to your class as you start the game. So from here, you step out of the tutorial area into the beginning section of Majula, and if you immediately go off to the left, you sort of find yourself going through this little valley or chasm, I suppose, and you come across the first NPC in the game. He has this interesting Scottish accent. I'm not sure why they went with that choice, but it seems fitting. It applies to his character. It's a nice touch.
He's carrying a sword.
Yeah.
Very distinctive and very familiar.
Yeah, I think it's important to actually discuss that because it definitely implies the crossover between the two games. It's the Moonlight Greatsword, which you only get from the previous game by cutting off Seath's tail. So how he came across it, I couldn't even begin to fathom at this point in the game. I'm really hoping they expand on that later.
But I really love that. It's kind of like you look at that sword and you think, well, I made that sword by cutting off that dragon's tail. And if you think about the events that occurred in Dark Souls and the immense period of time that's supposed to have passed between now and then, and the journey that sword's been on, and then you stand before it while this guy talks to you about this statue that he's seen. I just think it's really cool to run across that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose dragons were always implied to be immortal, so maybe that sword will last forever.
Yeah. And it looks cool.
So, in any case, you start talking to this gent, and he doesn't tell you his name. I assume we learn it later on. But he does discuss in the next room that he's put off by this statue. And the reason he's put off is because it appears to him that it could actually be real. He acknowledges that there's no craftsman in the area, so it just doesn't quite make sense that it should be there. And I think we will learn a little later on in the game that these are real people and they got cursed in some way to turn to stone, and there'll be a way of getting around that somehow.
Absolutely. And if you go inside, indeed, you do see that statue. There's a lever to open the door and there's a statue in the way, and the game very helpfully tells you a statue blocks your way.
So he actually reminds me quite a bit of Siegemire from the last game, Ungenbro.
The way yonder is all blocked up, you see, by this god-awful statue. Heavens above. Who thought it a good idea to pit it there? I'm in quite the pickle now.
He sort of says, I'm in quite a pickle now, as he's sort of waiting there for something to happen to progress to the next area. And it's just reminiscent. Yeah.
I always said Siegmeier, but...
I don't know. I like Siegmeier.
But it's very German. Siegmeier.
Yeah. You're probably right.
What is with Onion Knights as well? There's an Onion Knight in everything. There's an Onion Knight in Final Fantasy. There's an Onion Knight in this. Davos Seaworth from Game of Thrones is called the Onion Knight. It's like a common trope.
I've never noticed.
I don't know what it's from. I've Googled it. What does that mean? If anybody out there knows what it means, I will give you a signed photograph of me if you tell me what the fuck that means. Actually, I promise not to track you down and give you a photograph of me if you tell me what that means. It's a decent reward.
Yeah, I think that's far more fitting for our fame level right now. So, as you head back outside towards the coast, you'll pick up a divine blessing. And this is something you could have got from the previous game as well. But there was a limited number, and I always never used them because they seemed quite powerful. And I always wondered when the right time to use them was.
Yeah, I do that a lot. And but I always never use them too.
They have really interesting lore implications this time around. If you have a look at the item description for the divine blessing in this game, it's described as water blessed by an ancient goddess. Her name is long forgotten, and the Magic Academy of Melfia denies even her existence. Now, we know from the previous game that they were actually made by holy water from the goddess Guinevere. And for those that remember, Guinevere played a really crucial role in the last game. She actually gave you the Lord Vessel, but if you did any form of attack to her, you learnt that she was actually a hologram that was being projected into Anor Londo by Gwyndolin, the son of Gwyn, Guinevere being the daughter of Gwyn. And it was interesting that Gwyndolin was projecting her into this realm sort of as a way of trying to trick you or manipulate you into linking the last flame. And this time around, the fact that the Academy of Melfia actually even denies her existence is odd, because even though she was a projection in the last game, well, these divine blessings have come from somewhere, so she must have actually existed. And we do know that she actually fled Anor Londo with a lot of the other gods at the time, and I suppose she must be around somewhere producing these divine blessings somehow.
Yeah, and it doesn't, if you look at the description from the last game, it doesn't say holy water blessed by the goddess Guinevere. It just says holy water from the goddess Guinevere. So how she makes those blessings, that's a matter for you.
Amazing chest ahead.
Now, casters have regard to this. As you enter Majula, you will have an opportunity to search the area for an item that's very important to casters. The item is the binoculars, and the item allows you to snipe with spells the way you do with a bow and arrow. So if you imagine it would look really awkward, you've kind of got the binoculars in one hand and the spell in the other, and you're kind of waving it around. If you've ever seen someone looking through binoculars and trying to walk, I'm sure you can imagine what it would look like. But either way, the point is that you need to have a thorough look at the area, because I actually didn't the first time I played, and it really makes life easier when you have that. So have a look around before you abandon Majula.
Now, I think it's also important to note that before you come across those binoculars, if you've gotten as far as finding them, right before that, you come across the Morning Star, which is a mace that inflicts bleed damage, as well as the Sacred Chime.
Yeah, and the reason that I skipped over mentioning the Morning Star is because relying on things like that is a sign of what? Low intelligence. Anyway, get the binoculars, have a look at the Morning Star, if you're into that, and head into Majula proper.
So, as we walk into Majula, we are entering the nexial sort of area for the game. This is what will link most of the other areas, and it's also where you'll come across some of the most important NPCs in the game.
For instance, you'll come across the Emerald Herald, who, as we said earlier, kind of fulfills the role that was played by the Maiden in Black in Demon's Souls, and also performs some duties like allowing you to level up, reinforcing your Estus flask, all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, so she's arguably the most important NPC in the game. Without her, you'd be stuck at whatever level you spawn in, and you would never be able to get more Estus flasks.
Yes, absolutely. So it's very important that you do not harm her in any way.
God, I've always had that problem with the game, accidentally bumping R2 right while standing in front of an NPC. Now, she actually gives you your main mission from this point on for the game.
Bearer of the curse, seek misery. For misery will lead you to greater, stronger souls. You will never meet the king with a soul so frail and pallid.
She tells you to seek misery. What that implies to me, because she then goes on to tell you about the four unutterable names that are endowed with immense souls. This is sort of paving the way to four big enemies that you're going to come across that have a larger amount of souls than any of the other lowly mobs that you'll come across in the game. And you need these souls to progress.
Yeah, she in fact says you won't meet the king with a soul. So I think she says weak and pallid. So she actually says quite clearly, misery will lead you to greater, stronger souls. And I think that's kind of, again, fitting with that theme of if you are undead, it is your curse to die again and again and again.
To me, I actually interpreted the misery leads you to greater, stronger souls as seeking out these bosses will always lead to misery, because as we know from the Dark Souls games, any boss can be quite a challenge at first, and it always makes you depressed and sad to come across a new boss that you just can't overcome until you do. And I think you need to go out and seek that misery to better yourself and get that next hurdle in the game to progress.
Absolutely. And I mean, I get involved in the lore of things a little more than most people perhaps, but every time that an ogre picks me up and not just bites, but chews my head off, or I get run through, or I catch on fire, or I fall off a cliff, I always think the trauma of that event is so horrific that ultimately that will drive me insane and I will lose all of my faculties and become a mess. And it's kind of like, it almost makes dying, even though it's much more common in this game, much more horrible than in other games. It's not just a, oh, damn, I died. It's a, oh, God, now he's chewing my face off.
And I'm one step closer to insanity.
I kind of like that. You are seeking misery.
So, second to the Emerald Herald, there's some other important NPCs in this area. The next one that you'll come across is probably the unnamed blacksmith, who we later learn is called Blacksmith Leningrad. Leningrast.
That's terrible. Anyway.
He's a blacksmith that you quickly learn has been locked out of his house, and you have been given the task of finding his key to get him in.
Who are you? Oh, it doesn't matter. Just help me open this door. I packed my tools in here, seeing it was vacant. But now somebody's gone and locked the door.
He's a bit short and rude about it, though, I found.
Yeah, that guy's a dick. And, I mean, he's a stupid dick for two reasons. Firstly, if he locked the door, why doesn't he have... Oh, no, wait, he didn't lock the door. Someone came along and locked the door after putting stuff in there. So, firstly, he's an idiot because he left his all-important tools, which he laments not having, unguarded in a room that someone else came along and locked. So he got himself into that mess. But secondly, he could just climb in the window or knock down the wall. If he cares that much about his damn tools, just sit around moping about it.
Man of action, are you, Scott?
Well, it's just a bit annoying. He's rude to me about it. He's the idiot.
So a little around the bend is Morlin, the armor merchant. He's in the first building on the left, and he's possibly the first place you'll be able to pick up shield?
Yeah, you know, I didn't buy a shield from Morlin, but you can buy a shield. He sells armor wares.
Yeah, armor and shields. Now, this guy, he's a little depressing, because...
Yeah, I feel really sorry for poor Morlin.
Hello there. Well, welcome to my shop. I'm Morlin, and I sell armor. Oh, sorry, please do have a look at my wares. I could really use the business.
Yeah.
He has a very timid nature and he's just really down in the dumps. He came from Volgan, and he says that Volgan, you know, you have to kind of, it's very competitive and you really have to grease the wheels. And obviously he's talking about bribing the right people.
In this case, the Blue Sentinels. He claims the Blue Sentinels have taken over Volgan, and to get anywhere, you sort of have to be in with them. And
yeah.
Sort of makes me sad because the Blue Sentinels is a covenant that I would have otherwise been happy to be a part of.
Yeah, it's very interesting that, isn't it? I don't know whether he's saying that you have to bribe them or he's saying you have to bribe other people, but you just need their blessing, because he says you can't even open a store without their blessing. I kind of got the impression there's some kind of political or economic structure there that you have to bribe, but long story short, Volgan wasn't the place for poor Morlin, but neither is Majula.
Yeah, for now. That's all we'll say for the moment, but he... perks up a little later, I find.
Oh, beautiful. He's valuable if you want to get some armor items that you didn't have initially. I did buy a nice helmet off him, actually. It is nice. It's got a big feather on
top. You're talking about the one with the big feather sticking out the top?
Yeah, the Falconer helmet. It's a really nice helmet.
Every time I saw you play with that, I couldn't help but laugh at your cockhead.
What?
What's a feather?
My cockhead. That's not... I don't know how your anatomy is, right? But I don't think it's supposed to be anything like that.
So, in the house opposite Morlin is Shalaqua... Shaliqua.
Shalqua.
I don't know. Enchanté.
Enchanté.
The cat. And interestingly, this cat really likes the way you smell. I think you've got a theory about that.
Yeah, it's because you're a corpse.
Oh, yes. You may call me Shalqua. Enchanté. So, what did you want anyway? Ooh, you smell wonderful.
She's a creepy cat, you know. Cats are carnivores. And she keeps going on and on about how good you smell. It gets a bit creepy. I think it's because she wants to eat you.
Now, Shalqua...
Shalqua.
Fuck you.
Shalqua. Go on, say it with me. Shalqua.
Shalqua. Now, Shalqua actually plays quite an important role in this game. She's similar to Oswald of Karim in the last game. She allows you to check up on your covenants and what level you're in with them, but also allows you to leave a covenant. Aside from this, she also sells a number of consumables and some very important rings.
Yeah, and I think that one of the interesting things about her is that I've discovered that if you strike her, she mocks you. You know, she's one of the few NPCs that actually you can get away with striking. And she just has a go at you about it, you know. Ooh, try again or whatever. And then after that, she's perfectly happy with you.
So maybe it's similar to Oswald where he could forgive your sins and she's unsinnable, I suppose.
She does sell important rings. One of them is particularly important for two reasons. Firstly, it's important for progression, or at least it's one route that you can take to progress in a certain direction. And secondly, it's got an interesting implication as far as Shalqua's nature. It's a silver cat ring. And the item description says that it is said, and I'm paraphrasing, that when a cat grows old, a force brews within it and it transforms into something else. I'm really interested in Shalqua. You know, obviously she's very similar to Alvira from the previous game. And I kind of wonder, are they related?
So much that she's a cat.
Well, she's a talking cat with a big wide mouth that says creepy things. Well, that's pretty similar.
Fair enough.
Name another character that's similar to Alvira. Go on.
Cheshire Cat, Alice in Wonderland.
Within the universe.
Damn it.
Yeah, there you go. So are they the same cat? Are they did a force brew within Alvira and she turned into Shalqua?
I'm not sure about that. Hopefully we'll learn some more and have more to say about it a little later in the game. I interpreted it more that it's even possible that a cat actually turned into the ring itself, because it says transforms into something different, not transforms into another cat.
Well, that's something different. You just said they're not even related.
It is.
Well, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll see.
I guess nobody knows at the moment.
Yeah.
By nobody, I mean the two of us in this room.
If you leave the ring on your chest at night and you wake up with its butt in your face, it's probably the cat. I also noticed she points you towards the old ones, the four that have grown incredibly ancient. She says they must have grown quite a layer of moss by now. And actually, my partner noticed something really interesting about that. She said that there's kind of a theme of fours going on, isn't there?
You know, always within the Dark Souls games.
There's four old ones in this game. There are four firekeepers, if you include the fourth crone that's missing. There were four kings in Dark Souls. The Witches of Izalith had four daughters. There were four parties that first
possibly
contributed.
Five. I'm not sure about that yet.
You may be. We're a bit
we may need a fact check.
Sure, about what happens just before you go into the Bed of Chaos, but it seems there's four named daughters at least. And also, if you think about the Furtive Pygmy, Gwyn, Nito, and the Witch of Izalith, the four characters mentioned in the beginning of Dark Souls. So there's like four... Seems to be some kind of important number.
Did you also mention that there's four Lord Souls that you need to fill the Lord Vessel?
Yeah, that's interesting as well. I wonder about that.
It's the Law of Fours.
I mean, Bungie had their seven. Bungie loved seven all throughout the Halo universe. So, you know.
It's interesting. It just seems to be an important number to From Software for some reason.
Yeah, I mean, shit at picking names, From Software. I mean, how does that work in a sentence? I work at From Software. Mate, with sentence structure like that, I don't think you work anywhere.
So, outside the door and a little up the cliff, you come across a monument. Now, the monument's interesting in and of itself because you can go up and interact with it, and it tells you how many total deaths there has been in the game universe so far. Now, that includes every player in the world playing this game.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting.
I think it's interesting as well. However, I actually thought that it was only calculating my amount of deaths in the game. And the reason you and I thought that was because when we first started playing the game, Australia had some issues with the servers. And so it wasn't calculating everyone else's deaths because we weren't online at that point.
But imagine if you'd made that assumption that it was just about you. And then while you're playing, the servers come online and you don't really notice. And then you're like, I've died a few times. Maybe I'll go check.
19 million.
Whoa, what time is it?
Oh, well, time is convoluted in the Dark Souls universe.
Yeah, and dying that many times will make you go insane. You probably will forget.
Yeah.
Oh, God, so, it's happening again.
And on the other side of the monument, there's another plaque that you can interact with as well, but
it says the words are worn beyond reading or some such.
Yeah, so I'm not sure if
I think later on we're going to be able to clean it up or install something there or something's going to happen. Definitely.
I'm not sure.
Can you think of anything from within the Souls universe that you can interact with that doesn't amount to anything?
I think it's possible.
Maybe.
I'm going to leave that one open-ended for now. We'll come back to it later, I'm sure. Now, Solden sits near the monument. Solden sort of takes the place of the crestfallen warrior from the last game.
I am Solden. And like you, I lost everything. And now I'm here. You probably heard that it was possible to break the curse here. Well, that's not true at all. There's nothing here for you, me, or anybody.
I think it's the same voice character. Definitely the same voice actor.
And he has that same kind of morose, defeatist, wussy little attitude.
Yeah, one of the first things he says to you is that you're drawn to this land under assumption of being able to find a cure for the curse, and his first words are, there is no cure.
Yeah, he suggests that actually existing in the world is the curse. That's some nihilism right there. You know, he's depressed. He's got to speak to someone.
I don't know how, seeing as he's sitting that close to the Emerald Herald, who is quite a dish, I might say. She could be 10,000 years old, though.
I don't know. Maybe learn some things. How to stand by a fire for a long time.
So, Solden's interesting because he teaches you a few of the basics about the game to begin with. Teaches you about souls and their importance and how you need these souls to fight off your
insanity. And in fact, that's something we didn't touch on earlier, but I think it's very interesting. In the last game, it makes it clear that Hollows want souls, but doesn't really tell you why. Whereas in this game, it makes it quite clear. They say souls will heal your ailing mind. And they say, hang on to your souls. It's the only way to stay sane. So it seems clear that the reason that Hollows seek souls is because that's a way to keep your brain together.
It actually gives impetus for all the enemies in the game to be attacking you because they're all undead or hollow in some way. And they're craving these souls. And you're walking around with this big bundle of souls within you. And they want a part of that. Now, Solden also teaches you about messages jumping between fissures in worlds, which is basically his way of saying, hey, you know, other people are out there and they're leaving these hints on the ground for you. If you see something on the ground, that might be what it is. And second to that, also, they're out there sometimes trying to help you. If you see a summon sign, that's what's going on. These are other people that are leaving these messages, real people playing the game. And it's always been the most interesting aspect of the way the Souls universe has dealt with multiplayer. You know, it's just a very unique.
Yeah, it's unique and it works, and I really like it.
Now, Solden also plays the part of allowing you to join the Blue Sentinels. If you choose to do that, he gives you a blue seal, which is a ring. And once you've joined the Covenant and wear the ring, if you get invaded by another player, it spawns two of these blue sentinels into your game to protect you, almost like bodyguards.
Yeah, which I think is kind of cool. And obviously you can tell why someone as defeatist as Solden would want that. He's kind of defeated by the whole world and wants someone watching his back. And he even kind of suggests that to you as well, that if you want to get on okay, maybe you should join this covenant.
The ring also gives you a slight HP boost, which is minor, but everything helps in this game.
Yeah.
The last thing Solden does is also teach you the welcome gesture. So for those that are interested in those funny animations for interacting with other players online, it's well worth talking to him.
Yeah. And just the fact that he points you in decent directions and gives you an idea of what's going on, I think that's pretty handy. So well worth interrogating him. I find one of the differences between this game and the last is that there's much more interaction with the world. And Majula, I think, as you explore it, is a good example of that. Pay attention to a well you'll find at the side of a building.
Yeah, that well actually yields one of the more important pickups you can get this early in the game, I find.
Yeah, you'll find a tablet that's mentioned, I think, by Shahua.
Shahua.
It sounds like something you used to clean your car. You'll also find an old overgrown tablet. It's called Victor's Stone and allows you to join a different covenant.
This one's more for the hardcore player, though, I find. The covenant's purpose is to make the game significantly harder. I'm not entirely sure for what benefit yet, but it seems when you get invaded by red phantoms, you get a pickup called...
an ore stone.
Mm. And the ore stones allow you to level up within this covenant.
Yeah, it's interesting enough. It's the making harder of the game is something that might have just been introduced to assuage the concerns of certain players who are going to find that it's a bit easy.
I'm sure it'll interest me on my 12th playthrough, but right now I'm not even going to contemplate that covenant.
Yeah. Now, the last thing, other than, you know, a couple of life gems and souls that are floating around Majula, that you'll find...
What kind of souls? Are they souls of a lost undead?
The fucking pigs.
God damn those pigs.
I hate God those damn fucking those pigs. Because the problem is, they're tiny. And so if you want to hang on to your casts, because spells are so valuable, you don't want to waste them.
There's a bonfire right there. That's hardly an excuse. They're just a pain in the ass. They have so much health.
Yeah, and they're also, if you slash them with anything, you're going to miss most of the time because they're so tiny.
And Christ, they pack a punch as well, especially when they get you in a pack.
Yeah, the attack isn't horrendous, but it's not weak, and they've got so much health, and they gang up on you. I hate those freaking pigs.
Damn pigs.
Yeah, it's like driving on the freeway, you know?
Damn pigs.
Yeah.
So the last couple of things of note in the area, there's a gaping hole in the ground. This you can't proceed with at the moment. To look down at, you can see that there's some scaffolding that you should be able to fall down to, but to even try at the moment, you're going to die every time. And next to that is a corridor that leads down deep under Majula. The only reason this one's of note at the moment is because there's a contraption within, which currently you can't activate. But a little further down, you can pick up your first free shield.
Yeah, Crimson Palmer, which sounds like a meal
delicious
you order at a pub.
Meal.
In Australia, the shortened version of Parmigiana seems to be Palmer. Whereas in other countries, I know, for example, America, they say Palm. But either way, Parm. yeah, so I just think of a chicken dinner every time I pick up a shield like that.
So from here, we're going to cover the Forest of the Fallen Giants next episode and that whole area. So for now, I think we're done with Majula. It's a very interesting area and you'll get quite familiar with it. It's also going to become a central hub for where a lot of the NPCs will end up throughout the game. So we'll no doubt be coming back to it many times throughout the following episodes.
Now, is there anything that we mentioned that you interpreted differently? Is there anything you noticed that we missed, or is there anything you want us to discuss in future? We're on Twitter and we're on Facebook, but more importantly, there are show notes that you can comment on that kind of engage us and the community of our listeners. So we'd love to hear back from you in that regard.
Yeah, we're not claiming to have the final say on things when it comes to lore with Dark Souls. We're just very passionate about the game and have a lot of opinions and want to discuss them with you guys in the community. So on that note, Church, what's this week's question?
What starting gift did you pick and why?
What sign gift did you pick, Church?
The healing wares, and they just seemed the most practical.
Mm.
But I find as a caster, I don't even really use them. Could get killed too fucking quickly. No, I'm kidding.
Only in PvP.
Yeah, I know. It's going to be a joke.
Anyway, we've been the Dark Souls 2. Next week, we'll be covering the Valley of the Fallen Giants.
The Valley of the Fallen Giants. Sounds quite phallic, that Valley of the Fallen Giants. Got done for pulling my valley out on the bus.
Anyway, that's our episode for this week. Next episode, we're going to be covering the Forest of the Fallen Giants. We hope to see you then.
You can't do a "we hope to see you then."
The Dark Souls 2 has been a Screaming and Digital production. For show notes, please visit thedarksouls2.com or join the community at facebook.com/thedarksouls2. You can also contact us via info@thedarksouls2.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review on iTunes or spread the word. Our theme tune is The Knights of Darkness by Zero Project.